and welcome to Tools in the Shed, a podcast powered by Cars Guide, ready to rip into car stuff that's caught our eye this week. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and with me is Staff Journalist Tom.
Hey.
And Senior Journalist Richard.
Hello.
This week, we're looking at Ford's upcoming EVOS, a family SUV for global markets and potentially a Falcon and Territory replacement in one. We'll discuss a trio of recent entries to the Cars Guide garage, and we'll catch up with the king of semi-controlled explosions in this week's Muskwatch. YouTubers, you can jump ahead courtesy of the time codes in the notes below, and you can click on the chapter markers in the timeline. So let's go. And look, in typical Byron fashion, he has done a deep swan dive into what is likely to be called the Ford EVOS. It's an all-important replacement for the Mondeo, and I think that was Fusion in US markets, a medium-sized crossover rather than a typical SUV. Think Subaru Outback, and to put them back into family car consideration across the world. And for our listeners in Australia and New Zealand, it's been patented. The name EVOS has been patented globally, or at least there's applications, and that extends to Australia and New Zealand. So it looks like it's heading here. So to kick it off, guys, I just wonder what you think. You know, Territory was a pretty good success, actually, for Ford Australia, while Falcon was just withering on the vine. Where do you see a wagon-style Ford family offering fitting into the overall picture? Is it potentially successful, or where do you see it?
Well, they need one because they've lost the Endura, which was supposed to be, even though they told us when we went to the launch of the Endura that it's not a replacement for the Territory. It's just like, you know, when your mum gets remarried and the new fella says, you know, look, I'm not a replacement for your dad, but you know he is.
Yes.
Right?
You just get to bed.
Yeah. Exactly. Get to bed. That's right. Pick up your shoes.
Pick up your shoes and get to bed.
Brush my teeth. Well, he wouldn't say that, would he?
No.
Look, it depends, because if this is based on the Mondeo, and the Mondeo was Australian-wise, a complete flop, even though it was probably one of the best cars that Ford ever produced. It was a
terrific car, yeah.
Look, we saw the EVOS in 2011 come out at the Frankfurt Motor Show. It was stunning. It actually looked way ahead of its time, unlike a lot of concepts which just look completely, you know, fanciful and never will make it in production. I thought it looked good then. This looks good now. Byron's story is actually really, really good. I haven't seen much about this out there.
Yes.
Look, it's definitely where transport's going. These sort of, you know, e-tron style, you know, SUV. Is it an SUV? Is it a wagon? Is it a regular passenger car? I think Ford's really hoping that it works. Ford's got another problem as well in Australia, and that is that we source a lot of our cars from Europe. Europe Ford is going electric in the next 10 years. So if we don't start thinking about what cars we're going to have here, we're going to have no Fords apart from the Ranger and Mustang. So bring it on, I say.
There are already accusations, aren't there, that Ford in Australia is the Mustang and Ranger. Well, mainly the Ranger company. So they need to diversify somewhat, don't you reckon?
Yeah. Yeah.
Tom?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Mondeo was actually a great car. I think you and I, JC, talked about the last time we had one in, which feels like an eon ago now.
It was an EVOS. It was actually an EVOS.
An EVOS ago, yeah, that's right. I remember at the time thinking, wow, like people are sleeping on this. Like it's a really nice car to drive. Like
well hidden secret.
Yeah, got really good practicality. That EcoBoost engine's fantastic. And the idea of repackaging it into a more consumable format is brilliant, because that's essentially what this is. It's like a true Mondeo successor. It's not just, a complete reinvention. It's basically the same thing, just high riding. And I was reading an interesting article yesterday. It was US focused, so I don't remember whether it was Jalopnik or something, but they were talking about how it's very odd that Subaru's Outback, which is essentially the same thing, like it's, you know, that lifted kind of crossover concept, is the only successful one. Like yep. you know, XC70 might have had its time in the sun, you know, 15 yep. years ago, that sort of thing. But yes. how come we don't have more of these? Like, it's a really sensible body
You
style.
Wonder if the Holden Adventra was launched into the market now, it's probably its timing would probably be just right.
There are other options out there, you know, for an outback competitor that haven't caught on. Like, you know, you've got Skoda Superb Scout and things like that, just things that make so much sense, but people don't buy them for some reason. But the Outback just has that badge cred that it is so successful. And I think as well, for the product coming out of Ford Europe now is excellent. Like, it's taken such a big jump in terms of its quality, its drivability, it's everything. Like, if you drive a new, even the Puma, like, that's a key product for that brand, and it is really good. So
yes,
you know, I have high hopes for this thing. I think it's
well, according to Byron's mail, it's likely to be on this C2 architecture, which underpins things like the Focus and the Bronco Sport, so the Mini Bronco and the Marquee Mustang. And with that comes an electronic architecture that will facilitate Sync 4 multimedia. He's theorizing that it'll probably have your full-length display all in one touchscreen. Think Mercedes M-Bucks, you know, the MBUX system, to really bring Ford from the, you know, lower part of the pile to the top. That's important too, because the inside of Fords have been, you know, functional but not exactly inspiring for some time. So there'll be that as well.
Look, I think it'll be well made. All Fords are. I think it will look good. All Fords are. But I think it will be overpriced because all Fords are. And this seems to be the disaster. The makings of a disaster for Ford, because they do produce these great cars. The current generation Ford Focus is excellent. But it's just a little bit too expensive, especially when you're playing at that end of the market, when you're competing against a Mazda 3 and stuff like that. Just looking at these renderings of it that we've got on the website, it does look like a cool looking thing. It looks a bit Tesla-ish. I'm waiting for stuff like the electric Mustang SUV to come out to Australia, apparently at this point, according to Ford, it's not. But they need to push in that direction more.
I think our watchword or our key phrase here on the podcast is, but you never know. Palisade was never going to come here. Various other things were never going to come here. So you never know.
This is another case of not quite hitting the mark, because really what Ford needs to produce, and you just said it then, they need to produce a Kia Sorento rival that's not on the ladder frame chassis. For the Australian market, not another overpriced, well-made car.
Well, I don't know. I suppose we can theorise about Ford's track record in terms of market pricing and the spec level that they choose for here. But what Byron is pretty certain about is that the engine in this thing will be initially a 2-litre four-cylinder turbo petrol, 183 kilowatts, 387 newton metres, same as in the Escape medium SUV. That'll be the mainstream or mainstay.
Yep.
Then you've got a 2.5-litre petrol electric hybrid and a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle in front and all-wheel drive. So, look, there'd be a lot of bases covered there. So you never know where the price spread is going to go from here to there. And I think those things sound very smart in terms of making it more flexible in the powertrain.
Absolutely. I agree with Richard though. Like what Ford actually needs is the Explorer.
Yeah.
Like something like that, like a big kind of in your face 7-seat SUV, has a bit of that adventure capability, that's the product that we see for them.
This is not going to work. This EVOS is not going to work because it's not what people want. Right. Yeah. I know that contradicts what I said at the beginning, but like there's enough of these cars out already. And what Ford it is what people want, but it's not what Ford needs. What Ford needs is a large SUV that sits eight people. That's not the Everest. They need a Kia Sorento rival. They need a Palisade rival, and they don't have those.
Yeah. That could be a very simple one-page brief. to product planning and design and engineering.
Seriously, Ford will go to town. They'll get someone from France to design this car. They'll get somebody from Belgium to, you know, to make the interior. They'll get someone from the US to, you know, make the coffee. Okay. And they'll spend a lot of money producing it. And all they need to do is bring out the Explorer, Tom said.
Wow. Interesting. Yeah.
I agree. At the end of the day, like this will look great. We'll love it. Yes. But I don't think it's set for mass widespread success. You know,
It'll be removed from the Australian market within 12 months after arrival.
Wow. I'm starting the list now. We've got to mark these things down. Okay.
That's it. 2 years ago, I said there'd be no Tesla in 12 months. So,
okay. You don't have a great track record. So
withdrawn. It's not even released yet, but you've got it withdrawn after 12 months.
April in 12 months when we do this podcast, we'll have to check in.
Maybe how long did Enduro last for?
About 12 months.
Yeah. 12 months. I give it as long as the Enduro. The Enduro, which didn't endure at all.
We're saying it's codenamed CD542, according to Byron, and it's set to start production either late this year or in 2022. Mm-hmm. So if it comes into here, maybe it's late 2022. So you're saying by late 2023, EVOS will be history in this market.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Plotting the demise of a car that hasn't even launched yet.
That's right.
I hope I'm wrong. You know, I like Ford as a brand. They produce fantastic cars, but they just need a big seven seater.
Yeah,
right.
That's the thing, right? Like we'll love this car.
People won't. Well,
look, Byron, given his historical bent, also drew some lines between the EVOS and the Falcon as a spiritual successor for Falcon, and he said, look, if that's far fetched, keep in mind that the two share a similar do or die brief, even if they're separated by 60 years. The XK Falcon original was breakaway from the ever-growing full-sized American behemoths and comparatively compact dimensions and low-slung styling designed to tap into changing consumer tastes. Not only did it save Ford, but it was the later the basis of the Mustang. No. So what he's saying is this is a spiritual Falcon successor.
No, look, the successor to the Falcon is the Toyota RAV4, you know.
Wow.
Because that's what families have moved into. They've dropped their Falcon and Commodore and they've gone for a RAV4, a Seltos, or a Sorento.
I feel like Richard's just going for sound bites.
No, I'm not. I'm talking
big
the
declaration.
Truth. Speaking the truth here.
Okay. Well, very good. So
to say that a successor for the Falcon, did Byron say that, or is that a Ford marketing speech?
That was one Byron Matthew Darkus drew
has
those.
Just taken up a job at Ford as
he drew those lines.
PR manager, right?
Yeah, but it would be. I think that's a really good discussion. I think it'd be great to get people's feedback too. On what they make of the potential for a vehicle like the EVOS, 5-seat crossover rather than full-on SUV, 4-cylinder turbo petrol to kick off, but with, you know, hybrid and plug-in hybrid as well. Is it going to do enough to swing people away from, I mean, you guys called it, the likes of the RAV4, and will it compete in the outback space or will it be somewhere else? Be great to hear. And is it going to be overpriced? Do we think Ford could take a deep breath and actually sharpen their pencil and make it a little more competitive on the price front?
Hope so too.
Yeah. All right. Now we'll move from that to our own garage and we'll talk about cars that we've been driving. Richard, you've been in one of one here maybe. I don't know how many cars of this spec would be in Australia at the moment, but fill us in.
Let me just give everyone a hint. My left leg feels bigger than my right leg lately. And that's because I have been driving a car with a clutch pedal.
Yep. Just for most of the audience, can you fill us in on what that is, what that means? A lot of people won't really know.
I know. Let me get my whiteboard out and I'll explain how a manual gearbox.
There's a flywheel. There's a clutch plate, pressure plate.
Disengages the clutch.
Three pedals.
Comes in. Yep. Three pedals. That's right. I've been driving an i30N. Sorry, no, I haven't been. I've been driving an i30. It's the N line, so it looks like an N, but it's just dressed up to look like one. It's got a 1.6 litre turbo, and it's got a manual 6-speed gearbox. It's a sedan, which is, you know, I haven't actually driven the i30 sedan yet. And it's not, you know, even though the i30 hatch is a small car, the i30 sedan does not feel small at all. It's quite a, you know, elongated, you know, luxurious, swooping, looking fast back type of car. It's the manual has, when the first time I got it, I was driving everywhere really fast, like I was Bruce Willis out of Pulp Fiction in that Honda Civic. And then after about 2 days of driving in city traffic and, you know, sitting on hills and, you know, bumper to bumper, you know, peak hour, you know, crush, the manual's novelty was starting to wear off. It's such a good manual though. It's really light, really. I was thinking to myself, if you were learning to drive a manual, it would be a great one to start off on. It's very forgiving, very light clutch in it. But then there's all the other i30 hallmarks as well. There's great steering, there's the great ride. And it's just been, it's been a really enjoyable car to drive. But in terms of practicality though, I was a bit disappointed. I had some Cliviers to pick up. It's not a sexually transmitted disease. It's a they're a type of plant. And I bought some on Gumtree, our sister website. And actually did exit. And they didn't quite fit in the boot, and I broke all the flowers off, which was disappointing. Wow. Yes, right. Because the boot's so swooping. And then we my wife.
Before, was this, did you leave them over the edge and kind of cut them off like a guillotine when you brought the door down?
Because I'm a Neanderthal. I bent them to go in the boot and and they snapped off. Plants, not very robust.
Yep. We picked green, we'll just call you Green Thumbs Berry.
Green Thumbs. All Thumbs Berry.
All Thumbs Berry.
Then my wife bought a table on eBay, another website. You know, our sister website. And the tables had trouble trying to fit in the boot as well. I mean, you know, it wasn't
they were trying to fit themselves in. They had trouble.
Get in there. It wasn't a dining table. They were those little small tables. I'll get them out and show you later. And that had trouble as well. So I was thinking to myself, man, if this had been the hatch, they would have fit in. And that's the reason why hatches are so popular. And it's not because their shape is so pleasing to the eye, but they're also more practical. So
That's interesting, isn't it? That whole thing of, you know, you can look at the literage of a boot in a sedan and it's almost always bigger than a hatch or a SUV. But then actually the space isn't as useful for a lot of things.
It's absolutely the size of the aperture. That's right.
I mean, if you're filling it with milk, it would be better, but you're not.
Yeah, that's right. But the you probably need some baffles in the boot there to stop things getting out of control in the cornering.
Smell afterwards.
But when you think about it, you know, the move away from sedans was initially to small hatchbacks, then SUVs with a hatchback, which was progressing the thing even further. But yeah, that's interesting wake up or reminder, isn't it, of how limited a boot can be.
Yeah, now we're going backwards with the EVOS.
I say as well, I love that car's predecessor, like the i30 sedan, like the Elantra SR. Yes. That was such a fun car. And I think a lot of people just look straight past it. It had sort of kind of wily looks and it was really fun to drive though.
Are people are going to buy these cars? I mean, I hate to be the death speaker here, but like who buys a
death
sedan?
Speaker? Wow.
I see a few of them around.
If you had that as your online handle, I think the authorities will be sniffing around the death speaker. Yeah.
If I did, if you come on and it's and I'm there and I go, hello, that person dies in 24 hours.
Right. But so you think, sorry, I cut you off. You were talking about the car.
Yes. I was just saying that are people in the market for a sedan anymore? I'm not sure why a car company makes them anymore. If, as you said, you know, people aren't buying them, and as well, a manual sedan.
Yeah,
come on.
Yes, like seriously. That's what I'm saying. That'll be a very interesting car in the secondhand market. The one that you drove. It'll be a rare car later. It'll be on Shannon's, you know, auctions or whatever.
The last manual in Australia.
Or the one of one. Okay, that's good. And just to put you on the spot, Richard, what price bracket are we talking about? Roundabouts.
Look, the sedan and the hatch pricing mimics mimic each other. So they mirror each other. So you're looking at around about, i30 started around, low 20s.
Yep.
So your N line is up there with your Elite. So you're looking at mid 30s for that.
Wow.
So, yeah. But it's a lot, it's a far out, I've just driven, I can't mention the name, but a prestige car, and you have to option a lot of the things which come standard on an i30 N line. So it's good value.
Cool.
Good value.
Good, good, good. Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Now we're going to move to your good self, Tom, and you've been in another Hyundai, and please tell us about this one.
It's a really interesting one, and it's not super often that we get to drive something that's 100% a new technology, and this one is. It's the Nexo hydrogen fuel cell SUV. It's actually been kicking around for a while now. I think it came out in 2018 in Korea, and you can actually buy that car over there. Here, unfortunately, even though they did a launch for it, you can't buy the car, but they were launching it to sort of celebrate the first 20 examples that won't be on Hyundai's own test fleet.
Right.
The 20 cars are going to go to the ACT government. They'll be running them as fleet vehicles there, and they've got a real push for sort of a zero emissions fleet. They already run a few Leafs and Ioniqs and stuff.
Yes.
And this is just the latest addition. But the hope is, I think that there was a little bit less kind of focus on the car itself on this particular launch and more on the technology and kind of what it represents for Australia in particular, because there's a lot of potential for green power generation when it comes to, solar and wind and hydro. And one of the big complaints about those is, you have all these arguments about off-peak power times and this, that, the other, whatever. And then people also talk down about this kind of hydrogen fuel cell concept, saying, oh, well, the problem with it is it's some order of magnitude less efficient than if you actually just had an EV, because with an EV, you just take power straight from the grid. That power is generated, it goes into the car. There's fewer losses in the production chain for that per kilowatt hourage. But the argument against that, especially in Australia for hydrogen, is to say, well, we can stick a huge solar generator out in the middle of the desert, and it doesn't matter whether it connects to the grid or not, because what we can do is we can run that solar generator during the day, and it generates all this power, and it compresses hydrogen. That's what it does with the power, and it just uses all of its power to compress hydrogen, because it's a power intensive process, and it puts it in these cylinders, which you can then ship back to a main center, and you can ship it to places that aren't even connected to the grid. So it's quite versatile as a power source, even though theoretically it's less efficient than having straight connection.
The other thing that I find interesting, I do remember James May, the only one of that that famous Top Gear trio worth feeding, and he was talking about the Honda Clarity, and he was driving it in California when it had gone on sale, and there was some hydrogen infrastructure had actually been put into Southern California particularly. And he was just saying how convenient it was to be able to go to a fuel station and fill up. So there are the environmental concerns and the discussion around how hydrogen is generated. But from an end user point of view, it's so much more convenient at this point anyway, to be able to actually fill up your car with something and drive an EV rather than having to recharge that battery. You know, the alchemy that goes on inside an FCEV is pretty tricky, but it means it's far more convenient potentially.
I think in Australia as well, where, most of our electricity is produced by coal-fired power stations, I think hydrogen provides sort of a true environmental sort of, emissions solution in some ways, until energy is actually produced more renewably. You're seeing Teslas drive around with number plates that say LOLOIL, lol oil. They're actually recharging their vehicle using coal.
That's actually someone's name. Haven't you met
Lolo. That's right. Lolo. Top bloke. Great bloke. Yeah. Leslie. Leslie.
I have seen that number plate out there, so I hope he finds the podcast and comments.
Maybe he can have a go. I hope so too.
Have we broken the law by saying a number plate? I don't know.
No.
There's no, no. We haven't. No, we haven't.
I don't think we have.
We haven't given out his address.
No.
23 Cranbrook Road. I'm making that up.
Look,
I think, look, hydrogen's a really good alternative to diesel, because I think moving forward in the future, I think electric vehicles will be city-based cars. So, you know, your small sort of Corolla-style runabouts. And here, heavy industry will be powered by hydrogen, because hydrogen operates really well over long distances.
Sure, that's a good point, yeah.
So I think what you'll probably be seeing in the future is, yeah, city-based vehicles will be electric. You can plug them in, you charge them overnight. But for freight and stuff like that, it'll be hydrogen. So I don't know if the Nexo is the right size for hydrogen. I think hydrogen's a great fuel. And it also produces pure water out of the tailpipe.
Well, I mean, Toyota's gone down the same path with the Mirai, and that's been really an impressive kind of vehicle well. Mercedes-Benz has been, you know, experimenting with hydrogen power for a long time. There are a lot of big manufacturers wanting to explore that in case there are opportunities down that road. And I think there will be. Your heavy transport point's a really good one, Richard.
Yeah.
Did you have a drink, Tom? Did you have a drink out of the exhaust pipe?
The opportunity wasn't offered, but I've heard that you can, and it is quite pure. It's interesting you do say that though, Richard, because that is kind of the next big thing about hydrogen is, and Hyundai actually like said that full on. In Australia, they say, everything you see now that's powered by petrol, that will be an EV. You see right now that's powered by diesel, that will be FCEV. And that's fuel cell electric vehicle. And the thing about it is, hydrogen per kilowatt generated is much lighter. Then that's the key thing. It's much lighter than a lithium ion battery. And so Hyundai has just launched over in Europe its Exeunt fuel cell truck. And what that does is it mounts instead of have like a big lithium ion battery, it mounts these big fuel cells behind the cab. And that grants it they were saying something like, you know, you can get 1,000 kilometers of range out of this system easily, even when you have a payload, right?
And it's
the same with the Nexo. That's got over 600 kilometers range and it only carries 6 kilograms of.
And then you fill it up.
And then you fill it up, and it takes 5 minutes flat.
That's right. It's the same as putting fuel in your car right now.
That's really
interesting.
If you did want to know just a little bit about the car.
The car, yeah.
The car itself, because I know that's what we were meant to talk about.
Yeah. That's right, cars.
That's right.
Stay on target.
Hyundai actually agrees with you, Richard. They were saying that a passenger car is not the right product to proliferate this technology. They think it will be through the Exeunt fleet and stuff like that. But how it works is at the front, it's got kind of like this grid that is made of, I think they were saying that the membrane is made of tin and platinum.
That's it. It's a membrane. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, so on one side they pump in the outside air, and on the other side of the membrane, they pump in hydrogen, and the sort of difference between the two stuff happens.
I think it's officially called scientific and engineering voodoo.
That's how it
actually happens.
Isn't that what they say? Like anything that's scientifically advanced enough is indistinguishable from magic.
That's
magic happens, and then the two byproducts are, as you say, water and electricity. And it's got a buffer lithium ion battery, and it has a really similar motor to the one in the Kona Electric, so it drives just like an electric car.
Yeah,
and it's nice to drive. It's comfortable. It's like light. It's silent. It's a nice.
Well, that's
car
it.
To drive.
Just to circle back, it's what James May said all those years ago. It was early aughts or something like that when he was driving this Clarity, and he was saying the thing about the future, if this is it, is it's just like driving a car right now.
Yeah,
you know, but there's not a hell of a lot of difference. So interesting that's still the takeout.
It's not a foreign thing, the Nexo. It's a mid-size SUV. You know, it's so relatable in terms of like a product.
I think that's one of the issues I find with Tesla, is that I instantly feel like the dumbest kid in the class as soon as I get into a Tesla, because I'm like, where's the steering wheel? Like because everything is just so, you know, Museum of Modern Art in a Tesla, that I instantly feel like, you know, I'm not in a car.
Exactly. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? That has implications in terms of adoption. You know, early adopters are going to love a Tesla because it is that. It is so different.
Yeah.
Whereas your mass market is going to be more drawn to something that's probably familiar and more relatable.
That's right. I like to see Toyota start, you know, forget the Mirai.
I'm just getting the prediction roll.
A bloody Land Cruiser hydrogen powered car. That's the future.
Cool.
Hydrogen Land Cruiser.
Who's to say?
Runs on hydro, mate.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's even what, Hyundai's hinted at the fact that, a future pickup truck will be hydrogen powered because it makes way more sense than it does as an EV.
Absolutely, mate.
Okay.
I love it.
Very good. Well, thank you, Tom. That was a great discussion that went into areas that I didn't think it would. So,
What have you been driving?
Oh, me. Yes. I'll just rattle through a Porsche Cayenne GTS. So it's towards the upper end of the Cayenne range, but it's not your turbo and all that stuff, although it is turbocharged. It's a 4-litre twin turbo petrol V8, in fact. 338 kilowatts, 620 newton meters, 8-speed Tiptronic, all-wheel drive, $192,000.
Wow.
$192,500 before you put it on the road. And the overall, I could go into the detail, but for me, it's a reinforcement of a thought that I've had for the last few years, for what it's worth, that Porsche is now fully understanding this SUV thing. I think they made the original Cayenne because it was sort of a commercial imperative to broaden their brand and appeal to more people so that they could still make the sports cars that they really understood. We'll just do this thing over here. And it didn't, this now feels like a Porsche.
Yeah.
It's fast, it's balanced, the seats and the seating position, it feels Porsche. And it delivers its performance so smoothly. It's beautifully refined. The powertrain is just silky, but exciting at the same time. And inside, you've got these screens. It's Porsche's updated its game in terms of how the ergonomics work and how everything's operated. So if you're into a high-performance SUV and you're ready to spend that kind of money, that's in your market, you're looking at things like a Merc AMG, a GLE 63S for a little more. It's about 220. An X5 M Competition from BMW, 209. Audi SQ7, bit less, 162 and a bit. So there are plenty of players in that market and there are plenty of people ready to spend that kind of money on an SUV. It's not my cup of tea. That's just a totally subjective personal opinion. But the only things I could really find against it was it's in this paint called Moonlight Blue Metallic, which frankly is black. Until the sun really beats into it and then it comes up blue. But most of the time, it just looks like a black car.
Isn't there a BMW color that's just like that? It has like these tiny little flecks of blue micro in it and they call it blue, but it's like from most angles, it's just black.
Black. So to me, it's sort of like, what's the point? You only get to see it as a blue car once in a blue moon.
I've got a question, JC.
Pun. Yep.
Now, you are a former race car driver.
Only of the amateur variety.
Who would win? What would win on a racetrack? Phillip Island, right?
Yep.
Your Cayenne.
Yep.
The equivalent X5.
Uh-huh.
Or what is it? GLE. Would that be the equivalent?
Yeah, GLE? Did you and I do a test once, Richard? I'm not sure. Where we had similar vehicles, but of previous generation.
Yes, we did.
Sydney Motorsport Park.
Yep.
And I was actually really surprised at how good like an X5 BMW in this performance setup was.
Yeah.
So, and they've only got better since then.
Yes.
It'd be a close go, but this Porsche would be right there. It's beautifully tuned. I mean,
dynamically, it's great. Porsche is a race focused brand that the Mercedes would be about comfort and luxury.
Yeah.
The BMW would probably be a bit of both and the Porsche would be straight out performance.
I suppose it's just the evolution of Porsche as a business and as a brand, what it means to different people. For purists, it'll always be 911, with a bit of 718 on the side.
Yeah.
But for others, it's more luxury. It's more the brand statement and I want a bit of fun in my premium SUV rather than it being a flat out sports focused thing.
How did it go with the Bram test? Your mate, you're the purest Porsche mate. What's his view on it?
It's fun. Funny, he didn't see it, but I did take the 911 Turbo S to show Bram and we did a private road launch control start. Mm-hmm. And it started to turn him around. He refers to Porsche as the company formerly known as Porsche. So when the 911 went to water cooling in the mid to late 90s, that business ceased to exist for him.
Mm-hmm.
But he's starting to see it come back on the horizon. I mean, that was amazing. He's just, he was fairly flustered after that launch and thought, this is an interesting car.
There's some potential here.
He doesn't. Normally he flips the bird at a Cayenne. Lights. He just is dismissive of that part.
And what does he steer? What's he pilot?
Oh, well, his car's a 1967 911S, Australian delivered, sunroof, beautifully restored.
Very nice.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He alleges that Jerry Seinfeld is aware of his car.
Really?
Hmm?
It certainly takes a large pair of watermelons to drive a car like that at speed.
Sure. Hmm. Sure. Yes, and rock melons as well. Any of those.
any fruit.
Any of those, that fruit family. Yeah. All right, well, that was terrific. Thank you, guys. We've covered the garage. What we will do is just cover off a bit of feedback from last week. And it was all about, first to say, we had a lot of feedback. Thank you very much. And sorry we can't cover it all. But I've cherry-picked a few. And it was about Mazda pushing up into a more premium space in Australia anyway. And I think FBG Coot, I'm not sure if I'm missing something there, but it's FBG Coot, summed up a lot of people's views when he said, Mazda is a fantastic automaker. There are new drivetrain and ad companies sacking away from taking a nice chunk out of VW and becoming the new 90s Honda in the 21 to 35 year old premium and I presume demographic. BMW's new beaver face will cost its sales in the West. And that's a really great point. I'd forgotten the impact of China, as an influencer on car design and global sales. And if you think about making a brand statement, there's nothing like an enormous grill to do that. MBs look like three versions of the same car, small, medium, and large. Audi will gain from that with the right products, Mazda can too. And I thought that was a really well-considered piece of feedback on our chat.
I agree. Like Audi, right? You could level the complaint at Audi for so long that the design was just sort of, the same car scaled different ways. Now, like you look at new cars, like the Q3 looks awesome now. Like it's a really unique product that owns Audi, but it's also its own thing. I really like that about that.
And I think it's worth pointing out that we did call that out at the time.
We did.
Sometimes there's a lot of revisionism, it was at the time we were saying, no, these are too similar. there's got to be more differentiation. But
they really were. When the A3 came out, they all looked like the same car just from different distances away.
True. So, maybe Merck's suffering a bit of that, particularly SUVs, sedans, the whole bit. But then on the dislike side of the scales, Michael McLeish says, personally, Mazda is more like a pig with lipstick. I remember the GLC, which is the great little car. Now, I didn't really know about this, but in North America, apparently the third generation, what we saw as the 3T3, Japan was the familiar in the late 70s, was called the great little car, the GLC, in America. And he said, and the 626, adequate, but nothing special. Current models are tired and not modern. Admittedly beautiful design, but underneath the same old pig. The most significant development has been adding turbo. Here in the US, Mazda needs a big SUV, CX-11, and a halo performance car. Instead of going upscale with their current lineup, they need to focus on modernizing and being relevant.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so in America, the CX-9 is not considered a large SUV. It's considered a midsize. And he's absolutely right. Like, they need, a Palisade competitor over there for Mazda.
Yeah.
Do you guys know if, Mazda have a factory in America? Because that's one of the things that's been a big advantage for Subaru and Hyundai is they're actually able to build Palisade and Ascent.
Design centers there and factories there.
I think they have a few dealers.
We've got a couple of dealers. Look, I think I wouldn't say it's lipstick on a pig. Mazda is really good at making things look beautiful on a budget. So whereas Toyota is quite good at making things look budget on a budget, and Mazda's really good at making a really lovely interior and exterior of a car.
Well, the other thing is I'm as gullible as the next person. I am, pretty gullible, frankly. And when you think about the whole Skyactiv push in Mazda,
Yes.
All right, maybe that's marketing mumbo jumbo, but there was a genuine engineering focus on lightweighting, aero efficiency, optimizing economy and efficiency in the engines that was wringing the last drops out of, you know, naturally aspirated engines. And I think that was a real push with Mazda. I'm willing to believe that they were really trying hard on that score.
Yeah, look, you were watching the fuel economies drop and drop and drop and drop. But maybe it was also a bit of, you know, marketing spiel in that we're going to be asked over the next few years where our EV is. Why don't we tell people that we're concentrating on getting the most we can out of petrol engines?
That's right. See, I feel for it. I feel for it 100%.
No, but look, at the same time, they have gone a long way to, you know, reducing those emissions. You know, their 2-litre four-cylinder engine is really fuel efficient. But and now we're starting to see Mazda EVs. So
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said optimization, Jason. Yeah. I think that's what it comes down to. It's okay, well, you know, we want this engine family to last X amount of time until we can get a production EV happening or a hybrid, whatever it is.
Yes.
But I think the most interesting thing about Skyactiv X is, which is, you know, quietly supercharged. From the fact that it's got that cool, you know, combustion cycle, it's quietly supercharged. It does have a little bit of sort of mild hybrid stuff cooked in. And the thing I found about driving it was if it just had a bigger lithium ion battery and an electric motor on one of the axles, it would have been a great hybrid.
Right.
Like, why wasn't it? It was sort of, I don't know, a third of the way there, just a little bit further. And I think that's what we're going to see from, you know, Mazda in the future, is you'll see those kind of like high efficiency combustion engines
in
the hybrid system.
Great point. Now, we also touched on Mazda's position in the Aussie market anyway, being partly underpinned by their really solid retail network and the great, you know, customer service. And we got a lot of feedback on that. And one of them that I thought was terrific was Architect. Architect came at us and said, he enjoys the podcast. Thank you. It's great. We're back on YouTube. Feels great to be back on YouTube. A comment on customer service. Dealerships need to wake up to the fact that excellent service post-sales equals more future sales. Quick example. Had a chipped windscreen in my Range Rover Vogue quite a few years ago and was away from home on business. So called into the dealership to see where the nearest auto screen replacement firm was. Instead of leaving the dealership burdened with the problem, they simply checked the stock, took the car in, gave me a courtesy car, replaced the screen and sorted the insurance. Absolutely first class. I'd never been a customer of theirs before. So I thought, if that's what they do and I wasn't a customer, what would it be like if I was? Answer, totally superb. And over the last 12 years, resulted in the purchase of 3 replacement Range Rovers, changed every 3 years. Family had 2 Defenders and Discovery. The power of good after-sales customer service, I became a total fan of the dealership. And he actually references a book called Raving Fans that underscores this concept that people can become a raving fan. So he says, if dealers want to realize sales growth, invest in great post-sale service. It works. So amazing. Great story.
It's so true, though. We've all been to, a restaurant or wherever, a shop, and we've got bad service and we've never gone back.
That's right.
It's the same with dealerships as well. And they are not all the same.
Yeah.
There are some really good ones and there are some ones which could be better in terms of their service and what they do for their customers. And you'll find the ones that have really good customer service are doing really well as businesses as well.
Yeah. It put me in mind of the analogy I thought of was real estate agents. And they have their property management and they put their juniors on that.
Yeah,
because it's, you know, it's not seen as not a particularly challenging task. Of course it is. And if you own a property and you're renting it out and you get great service from that agency, who are you going to list your place for sale with? And if you're a tenant and you feel great about the agency that you've been, you know, working with and you go to buy a house, who are you going to go to first? It's an absolute kind of sales recruitment area.
Absolutely.
And it's the same in cars, I reckon.
Car manufacturers spend a lot of time retraining staff. Ford, over the last 5 years, had a major, sounds like we're Ford bashing here, but a couple of years ago, they decided to completely retrain all their staff because they realized that they probably weren't doing things the way they should.
And so they didn't know they were working for a car company. They were doing something else.
They spent millions of dollars.
Outdoor furniture.
And just retraining staff about how to customer service. And it sounds silly, but there's a bit of an art to it. Sure. So things are a lot different now, but sometimes you can't just rely on your staff being nice people. You've got to teach them how to, you know, serve customers properly. So
yeah. I think there's a degree of like, this is part of the success of Tesla, right? Like anyone who buys a Tesla kind of has this, it's like a tech showroom experience, you know, when you go to a Tesla place. It is, it's like the Apple shop, you know, there's just the one car there. And, you know, there's a lot of manufacturers moving to this kind of retail display model instead of, you know, a traditional dealership, because it's seen as much more consumer friendly and everything's set and there's no bartering and there's no, but I think it's the consistency, right? So with a car dealer, you never know what you're going to get, whether it's sales, you know, used cars or, you know, the
parts and service or whatever.
Parts and service. You never know what you're going to get. You know, you're going to get a nice place, you're going to get an old place with angry people, you never know. And so the thing with Tesla is it's just not, everything is consistent. You get the same thing. The car even updates itself and has these big changes overnight. And that's, I think, part of the reason why anyone who buys one becomes this acolyte, because it's this inclusive, wholesome experience that is like a tech product, you know?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because our old mate DeCool had a similar kind of story before. He is famously a CX-5 owner, and before he went to buy that car.
Is this to DeCool K?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's your pet name for him, Richard. And he'd been to a Ford dealer, Honda dealer, Toyota during the pandemic. And they didn't even know whether they could open or not, let alone show him a car. Subaru, he made him choose between a Forester and an Outback to even sit in. Test drive, not on the cards. Nissan, Hyundai, Mitsubishi, they'd let them see the cars, but had to come back on a weekday for a test drive. Mazda sales showed us, gave us the full info on a few variants. Test drive, no problem, despite the fact that DeCork had an overseas driver's license at that time. Even stayed longer to seal the deal, blah, blah, blah. And he's become a massive Mazda devotee, and he loves the product as well. And it put me in mind of when I was a junior burger at a particular, well, it was Mercedes-Benz. And I was working with Mercedes-Benz. And we were out in regional New South Wales, Midwestern New South Wales. There was a subsidiary in Dubbo, which is on the plains out there in New South Wales. And I went with the boss of that place. He said, "Come on, James, we're going to go and sell these people a tractor." And I went, "Oh, okay, fantastic." And we jumped in the car, and on the way out to the property, he told me, "Look, these are two sisters. I've been dealing with them for many, many years. I've sold them a John Deere. I've sold them a New Holland. I've sold them an International Harvester. He'd been in tractor retailing for some time. And now we're going to sell them an MV track." And we did. Went out there, and they were just ready to buy whatever he wanted to sell them, because they trusted him implicitly. They knew that they would get a good deal, a good product, and it would be well taken care of when they were dealing with him. And I thought it was really instructive.
Well, this is the thing, because people are parting with a lot of money here. They feel a little bit vulnerable, and they feel like they're at the mercy of this person they don't know, who might talk them into something. So when they find someone they can trust, you know, they stick with them. It's like real estate agents. It's like everything, hairdressers, everything.
I've stuck with my hairdresser for many years.
Don't leave them. They're doing a great job, JC. That's what that is, without blowing, you know, our collective trumpet, what, you know, our website's about. Like, it's actually providing people with information so they can go to a dealer and they can know more about that car than the dealer.
Yeah, maybe.
When they walk in and make an informed choice. So,
But with that's the thing as well, right? It's one of the things that's kind of missing from our experience, is having that retail of going in and talking to a dealer and trying to get a car out of them. And I had an experience, I think it was a couple of years ago now, where a friend of mine wanted to buy a brand new, standard sized hatchback. The choice was i30, Mazda 3 and Corolla, but it was before the current gen Corolla launched. And the most interesting thing, you know, you were talking about Mazda before having great customer service. We walked into the Mazda dealership and I just said, "I want this car in this spec and, you know, with these features, and I want to drive it now." And the guy was just like, "Cool," goes to the drawer, gets the keys, gives them to us and says, "See you later. I don't care when you come back."
And you never came back. You've still got that car.
That's right. And, you know, funnily enough, you know, he ended up buying the i30 anyway because he liked it better. But for me, you know, having that dealer just say, fine, you can have exactly what you want. Here you go, drive it, take for as long as you want. That was great.
Well, it's interesting because Paul Victor, our last commenter that we'll deal with today, said he has a CX-5. He loves the 2.2-litre engine. He loves the car. Mm. And he also has a Toyota. And both dealerships are a block apart and owned by the same group. Yep. The service couldn't be further apart.
Wow.
And based on our experience, our friends bought a CX-8 rather than RAV4 because they don't want to deal with the Toyota dealership.
Yeah.
Now, that's just a localized thing. Who knows? People are individual. People are people. That's his experience. But one point he did make last week, and I thought I should point this out. Another commenter last week, Jaylene Andrews, had made some comments about Hilux engines and diesel particulate filter problems and whatever else, and also cracked pistons. And that was news to us. And Paul said, look, as for cracked pistons in Toyota, there are quite a few, but the older previous 3-litre diesel engine, 90% of them has a chip tune or shot injectors that didn't get replaced in time. Same with any brand. So I think that's a fair comment. Jalen was talking about warranty claims, and it's a question of whether those claims actually get up. They might be made, but whether they're paid is another question. So important to make that point.
Yeah.
So I think that's the feedback. That was really cool. Good. Thank you, guys. And in terms of feedback, it's time for Musk Watch. All right. First of all,
I love Muskwatch. It's my favorite part of this podcast.
Full transparency here, and I'll make a declaration. I'm a big Jason Torchinski fan. He is the editor and overall controller of Jalopnik in the States. Big fan of his. He wrote a story during the week, and it was headed SpaceX Starship Continues Streak of Highly Successful Explosions in Recent Test. What this all boils down to is, he says, SpaceX's latest test of their prototype Starship SN11 upper stage came to an exciting and unfortunately familiar end earlier today when the rocket exploded as it attempted SpaceX's signature and impressive vertical landing. So they've been doing these what are called hop and land tests. So they go up to high altitude, come back, see if they can land it. And it blew up. And that's a process SpaceX is getting very good at, according to Jason. And he says, Elon Musk, the reclusive, barely known CEO of SpaceX, even managed to have a pretty good line about the explosion, noting that at least it exploded in the right spot. And yes, Elon was on Twitter saying, at least the crater is in the right place. And Richard, you and I were talking about this before the podcast. It blew up and debris went up to eight kilometers away. And for people on YouTube, there are a couple of images there, one from RGV aerial photography. A big chunk of this thing has landed on a row of carports. And this photographer, Lab Padre, his setup, tripod camera, some sound recording equipment, he's in the debris field. There are pieces of Starship all around him, and he's kilometers away from where this thing is. It was foggy, but it was an enormous explosion.
I you know me, I'm a spaceman. I actually watched the live feed of SN11 taking off, and God, it's so different to watching a NASA launch because NASA is so professional in terms of.
Boy, Dudley Do Right.
They don't ham it up in terms of SN11's like, okay, so here we go. We've been watching here is launch of the SN11.
Let's light the candle.
When it exploded, and it obviously did because the feed just stopped. And the presenter, because that's the only term for the guy commentating, right? He's like, well, it looks like we've had another very exciting test.
That was impressive.
We'll be back again. And obviously this is just a test, a very exciting one. And it's just like, come on. What a NASA, launch controller would say is that there's been catastrophic malfunction, right? And there's nothing wrong in saying that.
Sure.
It absolutely is when it explodes. Yes. But the footage of it exploding was, I found on a Twitter feed, somebody else's Twitter feed, because it obviously had been cut. Everything went really well in terms of reaching the altitude it was supposed to be at. It was a really foggy day, and then it came down again. Everything was fine, and then the feed just froze.
Which has just happened the last few times. That's yeah. It.
Look, this is the thing. But the explosion, right, was violent. So it was in this, it looked like something out of Sleepy Hollow.
Wow.
It was this foggy, marshy field, and then things just started to fall all over the place. And it was like big, like palm trees falling out of the sky. Like, and it was violent. Wow. It wasn't like a Hollywood one. It was like really like, oh my God.
The thing that stuck out to me was after the last blow up, which was funnily enough, the SN10.
Yeah.
Elon said there were multiple fixes would be applied to the SN11. So sadly, despite those multiple fixes, none of them worked.
Yeah.
And it's been another big, big blow up.
It's a thing with SpaceX though, because they test things by testing them, almost like a Silicon Valley style run out an update, and if it doesn't work, we'll fix it with with a patch or something like that.
All right.
Whereas NASA are so methodical, and because it's taxpayer money, things only blow up very rarely, and when they do, it's a huge thing.
That's a great point.
I think that's the thing, right? Like when it comes to NASA and ESA, there's so many like international and public stakeholders, in place that, and it's,
it's a great point.
Very up and down scientific kind of organization, these traditional space agencies, whereas SpaceX is kind of like, as you say, doing the PR on the fly, having this whole presenter attitude to it. It's such an Elon product, isn't it?
It's roughly analogous with my history in rocketry, which is a fairly laissez-faire attitude. And let's push it as far as we can.
Yeah. And look, I mean, things get done faster that way. Like you look at the progress of NASA over the, God, we haven't been back to the moon since 1969, right?
Well, not to anyone's knowledge.
Not to anyone's knowledge. There's a complete city there. But the way Elon's doing is a much, let's just make it happen. Let's force it, right? Brute force, really. Rather than a slowly, slowly, carefully, carefully approach that NASA takes. And I think Elon will be successful, but there'll be a lot of skin lost off knuckles and, injuries.
It's a great point. I think you make a terrific point. The great difference between private enterprise and, government enterprise publicly funded enterprise.
Government is more accountable, Like, NASA's rockets kept exploding like this, the whole space program would be shut down. But because we've got an Elon Musk, Howard Hughes-style entrepreneur, genius
at the
wheel here, things will happen a lot faster, but that's because he's not being held as accountable as a government institution.
All right. Now, just quickly, also, he posted up a meme, as is, his common practice on Twitter during the week. And it was a knight with a small girl reaching up to him. And it's labeled, and for people on YouTube, you ought to see it. And the knight is labeled my dad. And the thought is a dumb fact he already knew. And the little girl leaning up is 6-year-old me. So like, oh, that's amazing, dad. And then the second panel is 20-year-old me is the knight. And then the thought is an unfunny video I've already seen. And the little girl is my dad. Like, oh, that's amazing. So, there's the meme. And first up, I don't like this, said art by WOLP, by the way, as in he's stolen some art and not credited again. Then the aptly named, although I don't really know, Horny said, any chance I can borrow a spaceship? I'm getting married in August. Elon's so instead of a wedding car, just wants a rocket. I wouldn't want one at the moment, actually, if the SN11 is any guide. Yeah. Ryan Fabian says, speaking of memes, I know you're a fun, slightly crazy, dude, and so am I. That's why I would like to offer you $100 in HOGE, a cryptocurrency, if you tweak about it. So obviously tweaking is a new form of social media that we're not aware of. And NJ just had a Dogecoin branded Starship on the platform ready to take off because they all want him to mention a cryptocurrency so they can make some money. They just want him to make a mention of cryptocurrency. Mm-hmm. But speaking of share prices, Tesla is $6.35. It's about $5 up from last week. It was $6.30. But I read a story on the Motley Fool and it's a provocative headline. This company will make more electric cars than Tesla. And Antipodes portfolio manager, Alison Savas, says there is a better bet in the electric car field than Tesla, and it's Volkswagen Group, because they're finally cottoning on that they're being more aggressive and making big strides towards competing with and overtaking Tesla. Now, you probably clocked the Volkswagen thing that was obviously meant to be an April Fool's stunt that was leaked earlier somehow. And Volkswagen is, of course, getting very serious about electric vehicles, as all the big manufacturers are. But finally, here's a share market analyst that's waking up to this. Says next year, Antipodes predicts both Tesla and VW will sell around 1 million EVs each. Then in the years beyond, VW will outsell Tesla. Any first mover advantage Tesla had is arguably vanishing. And the Tesla bulls say, okay, well, Tesla's about more than just vehicles. It's developing autonomous driving and driverless taxis. But basically what this company is saying is, you know, Tesla hasn't solved these issues around autonomous driving. No one has. But ascribing $500 billion of value to the company suggests success is guaranteed, and it's absolutely not. So they're finally saying, look, this is all just based on hope and ambition as opposed to anything concrete
and speculation. I'm 100% agreeing here, and I was just thinking this week, how many EV reveals have we seen for cars that are 100% competitive with Tesla's now? Like before, you could say, oh yeah, Tesla did have a competitive advantage because cars like Model 3, Model S were really, really advanced for their time. They had amazing range. They had amazing interior technology. But now look at cars like Ioniq 5. It's hard to see that car costing so much more than a Tesla that it'll be unattainable or something like that.
Although, can I just say that before, what was it, around about 2004, Apple didn't make phones, and you had Nokia, you had say, you had all these other brands. Apple came along, and now I would say that I would probably Android outsells Apple in terms of number of quantity around the world, in terms of, you know, Samsung Galaxies and stuff like that. But iPhone would account for, I reckon, 40% of that market. So maybe Tesla will do the same thing.
Great point.
I agree. I think Tesla's made enough inroads now that it is going to be a mainstream manufacturer in the future. Like they've invested in the factories, they've invested in the technology, they've invested in everything to make that happen. And that competitive advantage has made them that way. So now that going into the future, Tesla will just be another manufacturer. But to have the scale of Volkswagen, to have the scale of Toyota, like, do we really believe this? And I think that's why there's so much speculation in the share price, because people who maybe don't have that kind of, encapsulating view of the market might have.
Oh, that's such a good point, Tom. I remember when we could all travel internationally, being in a hotel room somewhere at an ungodly hour, watching a CNN business channel. And there was an investor advisor just wholly taking it for granted that Tesla would have autonomous driving within 12 months. Taking that, sure, they said it's going to happen. So we're building that into our recommendation on the share price. And I'm there just going, no, that's not right. So it's kind of refreshing to see someone just going, no one's got the answer to that yet. Yeah. You can't bank that much money.
Well, and you can say Tesla's that more, you know, it's about autonomous driving as much as it is about the electric drive components. But, you know, look at what China's doing. Like, they're building like semi-autonomous taxis now. And if you want to talk about this idea of, what SpaceX is doing, just total trial by error, like, let's put it out there, see what happens. That's what China's really good at. Yeah, so they're going to be putting autonomous taxis on the road right now and just saying, let's go trial by error. Let's just do it.
Okay.
And Elon's got massive factories building Teslas in China. So he's in the right place at the right time.
All right. But he's got a threat, you know, if there's anyone who can sort of have the data and the facility to test in that way and overcome those hurdles, China's really good at it. So I think he's got a threat on his hands there.
Yeah, just because he's silly doesn't mean he's not, you know, doesn't know what he's doing. So I think
That's fair too. Now, on that note, I think we have reached the finish line. And I want to say thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
And thank you, Richard.
Thank you, guys.
And Mr. Pritchard has been called away to a gathering at the family villa this week. La Casa de Pritchard is an old windmill tucked away in a secret location in the wilds of Tasmania. He tells me these get-togethers are generally equal parts confusing and violent. He says the flight home often feels like leaving a war zone. So thanks again to Mr. Sullivan for stepping in to handle the production. His experience of last week has obviously made an impression because he's wearing a rather impressive gold military hat and was earlier demanding that everyone salute him before turning the mics on. Thank you, Brett. Let us know your thoughts. You can find Cars Guide on Facebook and Instagram or email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. If you're an Apple Podcast listener, please rate and review us. Remember, you can also watch us on YouTube. And if you are already, make sure you subscribe to the Cars Guide YouTube channel so you can stay on top of all our latest content. But before we go, the other day I was traveling down one of those spiral type car parks. As I set off on the top floor, I spotted a bloke smashing a car window and attempting to steal whatever was inside.
Oh.
On the second floor, I saw a young kid scratching a key right down the side of another car.
Jeez.
Then on the bottom floor, I saw a couple throw a load of rubbish out of their car window. I couldn't believe my eyes. I had to call the cops. It was just wrong on so many levels.
Oh, God. That's terrible.
I saw it coming and I still laughed.
That's the idea.
My cheeks are sore.